Truth, they say, is stranger than fiction. Nonfiction books have outsold fiction for the past 10 years. Nonfiction is taking over television. And now at the movies, documentaries are beginning to be more than just an occasional novelty. Last year, The Fog of War. Right now, Control Room. And tomorrow, Michael Moore's latest Fahrenheit 9/11. Though they differ in technique, all three documentaries are highly political films, either in their subject matter or their point of view, or both. In just a moment, we'll talk with the director of Control Room, and a little bit later in the program, Errol Morris joins us. He won an Oscar for The Fog of War. And we'll also speak with a documentary historian and find out about the extraordinary marketing of Fahrenheit 9/11. Also this hour, what the world's words schlamazel and googly have in common, but first, the rise of political documentaries. If you're a fan of this type of movie or a critic, give us a call. Has a documentary ever persuaded you to change your mind? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. The documentary Control Room is showing in theaters around the country right now. It follows the war in Iraq through the eyes of Al Jazeera, the Arabic satellite news channel. In this clip, Al Jazeera journalist Hassan Ibrahim speaks with a colleague about the network's decision to broadcast some violent images from the war.
We got the pictures and we show them.
We'll get grief from the Americans for showing these pictures, because we'll be inciting rebellion and we'll be basically instigating anti-American sentiments. I mean, I'm sorry. They can't have their cake and eat it. I mean, yeah, okay, you are the most powerful nation on earth. I agree. You can defeat everybody. I agree. You can crush everybody. I agree. But don't ask us to love it as well.
An excerpt from the movie Control Room. Filmmaker Jahan Najem joins us now from the Argo Studios in New York, and thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
That comment was particular to a time and place, but in a way, that's a conversation you might hear in any newsroom.
Sure. My general impression of Al Jazeera, people who worked at Al Jazeera, were that they were similar to many other journalists working in Europe and in the United States. They're just reporting to a different audience.
The newsroom that you shoot looks and operates very much like a Western news organization, Western clothes for that matter.
One of the editors that was going to work on the film when we brought the film back to the States was surprised, actually, and looked at the footage and said, I imagined all these people to be Iraqi fighters in uniform, or, you know, the military.
Fedayeen or something, yeah.
Something like this. And I said, what? Are you kidding? Because there's a woman with, you know, her jeans running through the newsroom when the bombing of the, you know, the first bombs drop in Baghdad. And she's very outspoken, a young Syrian woman who kind of orders all of the guys in dish dashes around her. So it's a very, you know, many of these journalists were trained in the West. They came, many of them came from BBC when the channel was started. So it did remind me a lot of any other news organization.
Tell me a little bit about how the film was made. You got permission, I assume, from Al Jazeera to get access to all of this stuff.
Well, initially they said, look, come back after the war. We're way too busy right now. We don't need a little filmmaker underfoot here. Finally, my partner and I, Hani Salama, who's an Egyptian-Bosnian filmmaker, and I got access after about a week of sitting in the guard's office hoping something exciting would happen, like a Bin Laden tape would be dropped off.
Mm-hmm.
We finally got access, and initially, we were said, okay, well, can you stay out of the newsroom? And so we went into the cafeteria very depressed, because how are we going to really make a story about these people if we can't even have access to the newsroom? And that's where we found out that most of the most fascinating, interesting, funny, kind of dynamic conversations really happen over tons of cigarettes and coffee in the cafeteria. And we met Hassan Ibrahim and Samir Khader, who's the senior producer of Al Jazeera. And they said, look, just stick with us. We'll get you in. And I think it affected them that we weren't funded by anybody. We weren't funded by Americans, an Arab, you know, network, or a European network. We were just two independent, very low-budget filmmakers working off of credit cards trying to figure out what was going on during this war.
Did you go in with an idea, and it doesn't sound as if you did, of, you know, we need this and this, and we're going to structure it this way, an idea of what the final product would be, or did you just go in and shoot whatever you were going to shoot and then cut it together afterwards?
All you know is that you need to be following something that intrigues you, and you need to be finding charismatic characters that believe strongly in what they're doing and really, you know, feel like they're going to be under a lot of pressure. I wasn't sure who those characters would be. Initially, I wanted to be inside the Emir of Qatar's office because he's in quite an interesting position.
He certainly is.
He's obviously paid by the U.S. government because he has the U.S. base located there, and at the same time funds Al Jazeera, which is disliked by the U.S. administration. So I thought that would be an interesting balancing game to watch. Getting access that quickly was very difficult. So I started to look for the characters around that were going to be faced with a lot of conflict. The Jazeera guys were under a lot of pressure because a bunch of new Arab news stations were sprouting up, so they had a lot of new competition. And then both of the journalists I followed at Al Jazeera, I found, had a foot in both worlds in a way. So they'd been educated in the West, yet, are Arabs. And then Lieutenant Rushing, who's the third character that we followed, was a very interesting guy. He's who I consider the star in a way. Because
this is a U.S. Army public affairs officer.
Yes, he was with the he's with the Marines now. He was working for CENTCOM then. His job was to be dealing with the Arab press. And he had a lot of integrity. He said to me right away, "Jahan, look, I would not be able to take this position to be explaining the America's role in Iraq if I didn't strongly believe in it." Yet you knew that he was going to be challenged every single day because he was going to be talking to people who had very different opinions of what was going on. He was going to be talking to the Arab journalists. And he was somebody that was really trying to find some kind of common ground. I mean, he says now, "Look, I don't like everything Al Jazeera reports. And whether we like it or not, they are the voice of the Arab world. They are reaching a huge population in the Arab world. As you played in your clip, everybody has access to a satellite dish. You can't control it now. So all the best thing that we can do is engage with them in some way." And that's what he did. And he made friends with Al Jazeera reporters. I think he got a lot more airtime, and he was really trying to understand the other side. The conversations that he had with people got to a much deeper level than just a press officer kind of spinning the line of the day. And I think that freaks out people. He's not allowed to speak now about. Many journalists have wanted to talk to him about the film, and he was really excited to talk about it. But the Marines have not let him talk about it. And I think that moderation or that, you know, focusing on the gray areas or trying to focus on kind of the other, he saw the other as human beings, you know, somebody that he wasn't talking down to the other side. And I think that was amazing to watch.
If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And let's talk with Malik, who joins us from Virginia Beach, Virginia.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
A quick question for your New York guest. This word shock and awe, it outraged the Islamic community around the globe. I was visiting some other places. I was asking the producer of this movie, what was the reaction on the streets on in Arabian Peninsula, especially in the Gulf, in the Middle East, of this, I would say, very defaming, very inhumane. I mean, whenever the bombs drop, you know, there's no shock and awe. It really, really offended me and offended so many other Muslims. I wanted her input.
Jahan Najim?
I think you saw the same reaction across the Arab world, and as somebody whose mother, my mother's American from Indiana, and I feel very, feel very proudly a part of being Egyptian and American. But my American side, while I was there, was just, groaning. You saw people listen to the description of what was about to happen—a shock and awe campaign—and you saw these 10-ton bombs being loaded onto these planes, and in the States, I guess the people in the United States watching the news, you just don't. This is what people have said to me after watching the film, that you see these bombs being loaded, you see all of these tanks going out, but you don't imagine that there's kind of another side to it because you don't see the pictures of it. You don't see the destruction that happens afterwards. And And Al Jazeera and all of the people that I spoke to in the Arab world were, they were just kind of watching this, like, how can this be something to be publicized, the Shock and Awe campaign? And the distressing thing as an American is that it's not doing anything to eradicate terrorism. It's not doing anything to, I mean, it just increases anti-American sentiment. And I guess if I have a bias, that's it, that I don't think that you can solve the problems that you're trying to solve through violence. I do believe that violence creates more violence.
Not just to be fair, the great majority of the bombs dropped in Iraq were not 10-ton bombs.
That's what we saw on the television. We saw these huge bombs being loaded onto the planes, and I don't know. I don't know very much about military equipment
for testing
or the size
in Florida.
Of the bombs,
they weren't used actually in the war. But thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jahan Najam is the filmmaker who is responsible for the documentary Control Room about Al Jazeera's coverage of the war in Iraq. She joined us from Argo Studios in New York. And here with us in Studio 3A is Patricia Finneran. She's festival director of Silver Docs. That's a movie festival that concentrates on documentaries. And she's seen many of the latest offerings, including Control Room and Fahrenheit 9/11. Thanks very much for being with us today.
It's great to be here.
What did you think of these two films?
Well, I think that they're both political films and yet very different in their take. Control Room takes a more neutral stance in covering the story. She let it unfold. In Fahrenheit 9/11, I think Michael Moore set out to tell a certain story and found real people and real stories and put them together in a very beautifully crafted way to tell the story he wanted to tell.
Let's hear a clip from the movie Fahrenheit 9/11. Here's Michael Moore showing up unannounced to perform interviews, including this scene in front of the Saudi Arabian embassy.
Mr. Moore, can I speak to you for a moment, please, sir?
Yeah, sure.
How are you doing?
Yeah, good. How are you doing?
Steve Kimball with the Secret Service. How are you doing,
sir? Yes.
We're just ascertaining information regarding... a documentary regarding the Saudi Arabia embassy?
Yes. Even though we were nowhere near the White House, for some reason the Secret Service had shown up to ask us what we were doing standing across the street from the Saudi embassy.
I didn't realize the Secret Service guards foreign embassies.
Not usually, no, sir.
No. Did they give you any trouble, the Saudis?
No comment on that, sir.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll take that as a yes.
Moore, in his films, this is his third, he's the leading character and he's the star in a lot of ways.
He is. In this particular film, he actually is in it less. He's very much more taking a back seat and letting the story unfold. My understanding is Harvey Weinstein said, put yourself in more. And Michael Moore said, no, this is a story that's very, very important about it's an anti-Bush film. He wants that to get out. And he wants attention paid to how and why we went to war. And he wanted to get that story out and step aside a bit.
I guess, in a way, every film is political, and you think of documentaries going back to Don't Look Back about Bob Dylan all those many years ago, and the rock and roll scene was pretty political back
right,
then,
Harlan
for sure.
Harlan County, USA, yeah.
But what defines a political documentary?
Well, I mean, I guess I think of it in two different ways. There's political documentaries that cover election politics, the war room, or Fahrenheit 9/11 is in fact dealing with the coming election, I think. It's clearly made and is coming out at a time to become an anti-Bush film. And then there are documentaries that deal with international politics, and because they deal with social issues, they affect political issues and campaigns. So it's slightly different, and it's sort of a broad category.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about the rise of political documentaries, their arrival on the theatrical movie scene as well. We're taking more of your calls when we come back from a break. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, the address totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about political documentaries and how they're helping to bring documentaries from the sidelines to center stage. If you're a fan or a critic of POV, point of view, documentary filmmaking, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email totn@npr.org. We're speaking with Patricia Finneran of the Silver Docs Theater and the festival at the AFI Theater in Silver Springs, Maryland. And I wanted to ask you, we were talking about Control Room and Fahrenheit 9/11, the Michael Moore film. Not many people have seen it yet, but what kinds of forms are there? Are these exemplars of different kinds of techniques in documentary film?
I think so. I think that at the, for example, we just concluded Silver Docs, the AFI Discovery Channel Documentary Festival is our full title. But I think that they're very different in form in terms of the approach that Jahan Nujaim took. It's more in a tradition called cinema verite, which is to let the story unfold before the camera.
Mm-hmm.
And what Michael Moore does and what you're seeing with other filmmakers like Morgan Spurlock's Supersize
Me. That's another one out.
A film called The Yes Men that's coming out about two guys that are pose as World Trade Organization officials. These are films where the filmmaker had a narrative through line in mind when they began to make the film, but then they approach the subject and cover it at their real stories, real people. He's not putting words in those people's mouths. Lila Lipscomb, who you meet in Fahrenheit 9/11, a key character who loses her son, is a real character, and the words that she says about in her change in terms of her feeling about the war is very real. Michael Moore didn't make that happen. Mm-hmm. He chose to show it in a certain way.
As documentary films now seek a theatrical audience more and more, entertainment value becomes a bigger factor in them. When you try to be entertaining, sometimes you tend to stretch the truth a little bit.
Yes, I think that they're meeting theatrical success because success breeds success.
Sure.
In a way. You know, Bowling for Columbine made all this money. Distributors feel like they can go out with theatrical documentaries.
It was a question about is entertainment value going to end up stretching the truth?
Entertainment value can stretch the truth, but I think that what documentaries can do that you can't see on the evening news is go very in-depth inside a story. Control Room spends a lot of time inside Al Jazeera, which you cannot see on the evening news. So, and I think audiences are informed and they're savvy and they can ascertain the difference between when a filmmaker is manipulating images and audio to help create an emotional reaction from twisting the truth. I think audiences understand it.
You mentioned Yes Men. What else is coming out soon?
Well, The Corporation recently came out, which is another anti-globalization film. The Hunting of the President, which is based on the book and came out right in time for Bill Clinton's autobiography.
This is the Harry Thomason film, pro-Clinton film.
It's the Harry Thomason film that basically lays out the right-wing conspiracy, is what it's called, in Arkansas against Bill Clinton.
And at your festival, Death in Gaza won Best Documentary. It's hard to get more political than the Middle East.
Yes, Death in Gaza is an extraordinary film in which the filmmakers set out to tell a story of Palestinian and Israeli children. It only ends up telling the story of Palestinian children and how they are growing up in an environment where their choices are very limited and becoming a martyr is, in fact, an actual option. And it's an incredible, searing documentary, and unfortunately the filmmaker, James Miller, was killed in the process of making the film, and that, in fact, unfolds during the making of the film, and he sacrificed his life to tell that story.
All of these films seem to come from the left side of the political spectrum. Why do you think that's true?
That's a very good question. I think that documentary filmmakers have often been interested in challenging the status quo and looking at the stories that are untold, and perhaps that's why they seek to look at the left and challenge the sort of sitting government or the status quo.
Well, they can all be challenged from different points of view as well. So, I mean, that's not enough. I mean, why do you think that these films are all coming from, you know, obviously there's distinctions on that side of the spectrum, but nevertheless, these are all from the left.
Well, I think that there are other films made that are from the right, although I would say, yes, the vast majority of the documentaries that I look at are made from the left, and it could be that those that liberal individuals are more interested in telling these kinds of stories. You know, there's no money in documentary filmmaking, so they're not motivated by money. They tend to be motivated by advancing their story. They can't get their story out there in the mainstream media, so they pursue documentary filmmaking to try and advance the causes and the issues and the ideas that they want to see portrayed on the screen.
Patricia Finneran, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Patricia Finneran runs Silver Docs, a documentary film festival with the American Film Institute and the Discovery Channel, and was kind enough to join us here today in Studio 3A. Let's talk now with Michael Renoff. Most people's idea of a documentary is a more like Control Room, one that lets the events unfold. But according to Michael Renoff, that style is actually a relatively new phenomena in documentary film. He's Associate Dean of the School of Cinema Television at the University of Southern California, author of a new book about the history of documentaries called The Subject of Documentary. He joins us from his office in Los Angeles. Thanks very much for being with us today.
A pleasure.
Some argue that Michael Moore's film Fahrenheit 9/11 is not a true documentary. I understand you haven't had a chance to see it yet, but if we assume it's more or less along the lines of the techniques that we saw in Michael Moore's earlier movies, what would you say to that?
The work of Michael Moore fits into a pretty long history of documentary filmmaking, which takes an advocacy position that really attempts to be persuasive, has a very strong point of view and attitude towards the material. There's nothing terribly groundbreaking about his approach.
Of making himself as the star?
Well, that may be somewhat of a difference in terms of the persuasive filmmaking style that includes the filmmaker. He's by no means the first, but but this is something that's probably been more prevalent in the last, say, 20, 25 years at least.
What might be another example of it?
Well, there's someone named John Alpert, who for a long time has made, since the early 70s, so I'm guessing about 30 years now, and for a while showed his work was shown on the Today Show in the 80s, but has been very consistent with making films, videotapes that were about breaking issues around the world, and he was very much a part of them. He shot them himself, unlike Michael Moore. He was the camera person, and you could hear him speaking from behind the camera. So that's one example.
So what are the examples of the other kinds of documentaries you're talking about, the kinds of films that prevailed, 40 years ago?
Well, just on this point of films that may be about the political process or the American political process, the sort of groundbreaking, the milestone film is a film called Primary that was made in 1960, which was the beginning, really, of direct cinema, or sometimes called cinema verite, but that attempts to let events unfold before the camera without the use of interviews or voiceovers, but that the interest is in letting things unfold for before the viewer so that the spectator is able to more or less make up his or her own mind about what happens. And that
Frederick Wiseman uses that technique.
Frederick Wiseman, who came along in 1967, has been making films ever since, is probably the best example. Yeah. And so with a Wiseman film, since lots of people have seen his films, you're never going to hear Wiseman's voice. You may get a sense of his point of view towards the material, but you'll have to watch closely, and inferences will be very important. There still will be editing that will help to make you a little bit clearer on what his relationship towards the subject matter is by virtue of his choices, his selections. But you're not going to really have Wiseman himself front and center, and Moore chooses to put himself in the middle of things very often.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a listener involved, and Anina joins us from Portland, Oregon.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling to say that I actually prefer documentaries that have a strong and obvious point of view to them for a couple of related reasons. One is that no film, I don't think any human endeavor or creation is truly objective.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in filmmaking, the filmmaker's point of view informs every choice that the filmmaker makes in creating that film. And the related reason is that if a film has a so-called objective veneer, you know, and doesn't have an obvious point of view, then I have a harder time telling what the filmmaker's point of view is that shaped that film. And if it has an obvious point of view, even if I disagree with that point of view, at least I know what it is, and it gives me a better basis on which to evaluate the facts presented in that documentary.
So you prefer the point of view as to the more journalistic approach?
Definitely. I think actually the so-called journalistic or objective approach buries the creator's point of view to the point that it's in a way almost deceptive, because the facts that are being presented to you are being selectively presented. Every single decision, the angle of the camera, the moment you cut, what you show, what you don't show, how you layer the sound on top of the image, that's all influenced by the filmmaker's point of view.
Do you go see films with a point of view with which you disagree?
It depends on the subject matter. I certainly would be willing to see a film with a point of view that I disagree with. And as I said before, I think even if I disagree with the point of view, knowing what it is gives me a better basis to evaluate what's presented in the film.
Michael Renoff, is this a discussion that's active in documentary circles and has been for some time?
Well, the idea of point of view, as the caller suggests, is pervasive. The point of view exists whether or not it's explicit or not. One thing I'd like to introduce into the discussion is that sometimes we Americans tend to see things only within our own somewhat limited framework. If you think both historically and internationally, there isn't really much pretense towards objectivity or neutrality taken in documentary filmmaking. There isn't the same tradition of, say, broadcast journalism in other countries that attempts to be even-handed or balanced. There isn't that same sense of the need to even be in any way apologetic for an attitude or a strong point of view or an interest in persuading audiences.
Okay. Anina, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's talk with Steve. And Steve is with us on the line from Minneapolis.
Thank you, Neil.
Sure.
I think one of the reasons why the documentaries are more or less from the left is because much of the left's perspective on important issues like the war are just not reported in the media or hardly ever heard. And, you know, I mean...
Well, Steve, as you know, a lot of people on the right feel their opinion isn't reported in the media as well. I mean, this cuts both ways.
Well, yeah, but like on the Iraq War, for example, I mean, the Institute for Policy Studies is hardly ever interviewed, and the Heritage Foundation can be frequently found to be interviewed in the major networks. Mm-hmm. I mean, there really is no...
I'm just saying that the feeling of a grievance exists on both sides of the spectrum.
Yeah,
its accuracy is I'm not arguing about here. The grievance exists.
No, I know that's said, but I mean, think of how often you hear Michael Moore's perspective on the war in the major media.
Mm-hmm.
You don't. You do hear the Heritage Foundation's perspective on the war all over the media. You don't hear Michael Moore's perspective on the war. You didn't hear before the war, for example, what Michael Moore would have been reporting on is the low likelihood that Bush's claims about weapons of mass destruction were true. And we didn't hear much about that before the war. What Michael Moore does is he steps in and actually, you know, presents ideas that the media really are kind of afraid to touch on for fear of being labeled unpatriotic or liberal or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I think that Michael Moore is doing a very good service in films like this. He's actually exposing the public to facts that make them realize, oh, well, a lot of what we've been hearing being uncritically reported by the media are not true.
Okay. Steve, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And Michael Renoff, thank you for your time today.
It was a pleasure.
Michael Renoff is professor of critical studies at the School of Cinema Television at the University of Southern California, associate dean of the school, and author of The Subject of Documentary. And he joined us from his office in Los Angeles. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us now is, excuse me, I've got the wrong sheet of paper in front of me. And I've still got the wrong sheet of paper in front of me. Anyway, Errol Morris is with us on the phone right now. And Errol Morris, of course, is the director of The Thin Blue Line, Brief History in Time, and most recently, The Fog of War, which won this year's Academy Award for Best Documentary Film. He's with us from his office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And thanks very much for being with us today. I apologize for shuffling paper as I introduce you. Congratulations, by the way, on your award.
Thank you so much.
And I wanted to ask you some of the questions that we've been talking about, and that is the question of the political content of films. Your film, Fog of War, was clearly political. It clearly addressed the war in Iraq, but did so indirectly by talking about the war in Vietnam.
Yes, that's absolutely true. It pointed out that history may not repeat itself, but we repeat ourselves. We make the same mistakes over and over and over again. The problem is us. And the movie pleased me because I felt that I was able to address really important political concerns, but doing it without having to have some specific agenda, like I'm out to get this person, I'm out to get that person. What emerges is a story of confusion, self-deception, incompetence. It's also interesting because as we speak today, I feel the country is more polarized than it has been at any time since the late 60s and early 70s.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, your documentary in terms of its style is much more like Michael Moore's in that you set out with, I think, a vision of how to make a film and with an idea.
I set out with the idea of exploring how one very prominent political figure, Robert S. McNamara, saw himself in history and tried to explain to himself why he did what he did. It's pretty much agreed years and years later that Vietnam was both a quagmire and a disaster for this country. If there's any question in people's minds about whether it's a good thing to have a country so polarized, so divided against itself, the answer, it's not. It produced a whole generation, of which I'm very much a part, that became profoundly disenchanted with government and deeply suspicious of what government figures say.
Would you have made this film without the context of the war in Iraq?
Well, I did, because the movie was started well before the war in Iraq. The movie was started before 9/11. If you like, the context grew around the film. The film did not come out of that context. And so I was confronted with this recurring irony. Oh, my God, the central protagonist in my film is talking about events that occurred 40, 50, 60 years ago, but he could be talking about things that happened 4, 5, 6 days ago.
Timing is everything.
Well, in this case, it was unfortunate because history was catching up with the movie, not the other way around.
Errol Morris, thank you very much. And again, congratulations on your Academy Award.
Thank you so much.
Errol Morris, director of The Thin Blue Line, A Brief History of Time and The Fog of War. He joined us from his office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. When we come back from a break, we'll talk about the marketing of Fahrenheit 9/11. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, join Ira Flatow on Science Friday for a look at mental illness in children and one father's quest to help his kids, plus what a close encounter with a comet is revealing about the building blocks of the solar system. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation Science Friday. And right now we're finishing up our conversation about political documentaries and video clips from the movies Control Room and Fahrenheit 9/11. You can see them at npr.org. Tomorrow, Michael Moore's film Fahrenheit 9/11 opens in theaters nationwide. It's attracting considerable political attention for a variety of reasons, but what does Hollywood think of the movie? Will all the political hype translate into ticket sales? Joining us now to explain the box office prognosis is Dan Fearman, a senior writer for Entertainment Weekly, and he joins us by phone from his office in New York. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Neil. It's great to be here.
Obviously, a lot of buzz about this movie. How is it expected to do at the box office? Would you anticipate it's going to be the number one film this weekend?
Actually, I would not. And you can take what this means about our country for whatever it will, but I think the number one movie this weekend is going to be the Wayans Brothers movie White Chicks, and there's a very simple reason for that. Fahrenheit 9/11 is only on 868 theaters around the country, and White Chicks is on 2,700 theaters. So no, it will not be number one, but the numbers I think we expect from it will be blockbuster for the type of movie it is, which is a non-concert documentary.
And those 800-odd screens, that's also blockbuster for a documentary, no?
Yes, it is also blockbuster for a documentary. That's the highest number of screens for a non-concert documentary in history.
So given that huge disparity in the number of screens, that puts a theoretical limit on just how high the film could rise.
That's exactly right. That said, of course, you're talking about a very, very motivated group of filmgoers for Fahrenheit. So I think it will approach its theoretical limit, which will, I mean, I'm just guessing here, but be between $12 and $15 million.
Now, you talk about that devoted fan core fan base for the Fahrenheit 9/11. We've heard reports of groups buying tickets in block and from various places like Fandango, which is one of those services where you can go get tickets in advance, that this is by far the most requested movie.
Yeah, sure. I mean, and you have organizations like Move On who have gotten 110,000 of their members to pledge to go see the movie opening weekend. I mean, I think you're looking at a phenomenon where the left and, you know, the studios behind this movie have looked at what happened with The Passion very closely and have realized if you do have a group of people who are not highly motivated to go but are absolutely going to go opening weekend, if you organize them together and turn it into something larger than a movie, you can generally make more money. And that's what they're doing.
It's interesting, the comparison to The Passion has been made by others, and it exists in other respects. I mean, Mel Gibson went out and made his movie The Passion independently. It wasn't through a studio. Michael Moore had very famous difficulties with his studio.
Yes, he sure did. And you know, they both... I think that the other really cogent comparison is that they both had huge controversy in terms of how they got into theaters. I mean, the Moore movie very famously, Disney declined to distribute the movie through their subsidiary Miramax, and Miramax had to buy back the rights and create an entirely new company to distribute it. Now, that may seem like it's unfortunate for Moore, but the amount of free publicity they got from that was astonishing, and, you know, as a result, awareness kind of went through the roof.
And again, the same kind of marketing phenomenon that Mel Gibson got for his movie. And in fact, there's continuing controversy even today, this over the television advertisements for Fahrenheit 9/11. A conservative group has filed suit with the Federal Elections Committee, saying that, in effect, Michael Moore's television ads are anti-Bush ads and need to be reported to the FEC.
Yeah, you know, we are honestly through the looking glass on this movie. I cannot remember a time when a movie that is such a direct partisan political attack on a sitting president was released at this point in an election process. I think there really aren't rules for how this is going to go. And you know, you talk about sort of what's happening with the FEC. I mean, you have this atmosphere that's created that is also very similar to The Passion, where this movie is being positioned as a movie that the powers that be don't want you to see, which is a really attractive underdog position to be in, and you know, it only increases the sense of mission on a part of the fans of the film who are going to go see it.
Mm-hmm. This film, it's really one of a kind, and you say that saying it's also a lot like Michael Moore's last two movies, but really, it is one of a kind.
Yes, that's true. I've never in my career seen or heard of an instance where sort of the political realities, the Venn diagram of the political realities of the country and the presidential race cross so seamlessly with a filmmaker and what he's putting into theaters.
Whether it was conscious or not, Michael Moore has happened upon what looks to be a brilliant marketing strategy. But as you look at it, his approach to making these films is highly entertaining. Documentaries have the, you know, that slight odor of mustiness about them sometimes. That can't be said about his films. Does a documentary need to be, you know, slam bang entertaining if it's to make it theatrically?
You know, it's interesting. I think the better question is almost, is this a documentary? I might answer no to that question. This, to me, when you see the movie, it's a very, very effective sort of building of the left case against the Bush administration. You know, is Moore a documentarian or is he a propagandist? I mean, these are honestly the questions that are at the heart of this movie. And I'm not sure what the answer is. He's certainly funny. He's one of the funnier people on the planet. He's very witty. He's a very good filmmaker. But is it a documentary? I'm not sure.
And what kind of audience is he trying to reach? Are people who do not agree with him going to go see this?
That is the question. I mean, I don't think so. I think people who do not agree with Michael Moore, who don't like Michael Moore, I mean, there's a whole industry of books and websites and commentators who trade off hating Michael Moore, the same way that there's an industry on the left trading off hating, you know, Bill O'Reilly or Rush Limbaugh. I don't think they will. I think the better question is, will people who weren't going to vote otherwise, or undecided voters go see this movie, because that is where it has the potential to have some serious impact. As Moore himself is fond of pointing out, more than half this country doesn't vote. If they find themselves in this movie and are moved by it, then that actually could have an impact on the election.
Yeah, he himself says it's a film about rallying the base to get out there and be more active. Do you think it's going to work?
Who can tell? I mean, this political climate is like nothing I've seen in my lifetime. It's, I think there's no doubt that the hardcore left, the people who hate Bush, are unquestionably going to go see this movie. They're going to make Harvey Weinstein a ton of money and Michael Moore a ton of money. But, does that make a difference in their voting patterns? Probably not. They were going to go to the polls and vote against Bush anyway. Will the people in the middle see it? That I have no idea about. And I think when you see the Republicans basically saying, we're going to go to the FEC to make sure this movie is not being advertised on air as we get closer and closer to the election, I think that pretty clearly indicates that they're worried about it, too.
As you look ahead to this, Bowling for Columbine did very, very well. At the end of the day, do you think that Fahrenheit 9/11 is going to eclipse that and be the biggest money-making documentary of all time, whether it's a documentary or not?
Yeah, without question. There are documentaries. There are basically three categories of documentaries. There are your IMAX movies, like Everest, which play for years and years and years on end. They make tons of money. Then there are your concert documentaries, which are sort of outliers, like in the band played on or whatever.
Sure.
And then, there are your documentaries, what you and I think of as a documentary. And will it break that record? Absolutely. I mean, this movie will have broken that record within its first month. And by the way, that record is held by Michael Moore for Bowling for Columbine at around $30 million.
And if you think it's going to make 10 to 12 in its first weekend, it could make that in a month.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they're doing something very clever, which is they're releasing it on DVD in October, which is only going to cause more controversy and sell more DVDs. I mean, I expect this movie to break records across the line.
Dan Fearman, thanks very much.
Thanks very much for having me.
Dan Fearman, a senior writer for Entertainment Weekly, joined us by phone from his office in New York. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.